Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and I don't know about you, but I haven't been getting much sleep over the last few days. It's Thursday morning, and the US presidency still hasn't been called for either candidate. I have never watched so much CNN in my entire life, and I think I know more about US electoral geography than I ever expected. My teacher has been this guy called John King on CNN, who's been navigating this interactive map for the last few days. I don't think he's slept in 3 days, this guy. He's an absolute phenomenon. He can talk and riff nonstop, almost without taking a breath, about various counties in various swing states. It's been quite interesting to watch. Anyway, it looks like it's getting down to the wire now. We should have a decision soon, fingers crossed. And so finally, I plan to get some sleep tonight. With me, as ever, are Caroline White, Deputy Editor, and Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, Features Director.
Morning. Well, or depends where you're listening, I guess. But yeah, I am also very tired. I've been waking up at stupid o'clock and refreshing my phone to see what's happened over the night. It's very strange kind of being across the pond when something like this is going on. But I'll just be glad when it's over, to be honest.
Yeah. There was it seems to be trickling out in a very slow fashion now. There was a massive rush of results. And then there's this very, very slow inching to the final decision. It's quite excruciating, actually. But, you know, a bit of drama. Never hurt anyone, I suppose. Actually, a very clever digital team has put a bunch of presidential content up on the website to coincide with the election, including a feature that first ran in the 1989 edition of the Super Yachts book. To those listening who don't know, each year we publish this beautiful coffee table book. The latest is out now, I should mention, via the website. It's a very good book. Buy it now. Anyway, this book features the most impressive super yachts delivered that year. Back in 1989, one of those super yachts was Trump Princess, formerly Nabila, and now Kingdom 5KR. And you can see some pictures of the interior of the 1989 Trump Princess on the website. And, let's say the style is dated a little bit. Obviously, it's very different now, but it was quite special back in the 80s. Very glitzy, very shiny, bit of velvet, lots of pink, actually. So don't miss that. Go look at that feature.
So actually, Trump, when he bought Trump Princess from Adnan Khashoggi, he de-kitched it. So it had sort of chinchilla bedspreads and suede on walls and all sorts of crazy stuff. So his version is actually the more tasteful version of that boat, which I thought was quite interesting.
Chinchilla bedspreads.
Yeah, I mean, it had crazy stuff. It had sort of gold moldings, which I imagine might be quite something Trump might quite like, but it had all sorts of quite horrendous stuff. It's a very beautiful John Bannenberg boat, but the interior it sounds like it was really something else. And it's incredibly expensive, the interior to install. So yeah, taking that apart was quite a major activity, I think.
Yeah, but do go read the feature. It's quite enlightening. Talking about other presidential yachts, on the total other end of the scale was Honeyfit. This is a beautiful 1931 commuter boat used by JFK. He named it after his maternal grandfather and spent a ton of time on board, inviting heads of state and stars like Marilyn Monroe along for the ride. Pretty sure that boat's undergoing a restoration at the moment, but she is just that classic kind of East Coast New Yorker kind of commuter boat look. She's just lovely. A little different to Trump Princess. But again, I think you can see some photos of that on the website.
So actually, I've been looking at how the US elections might affect the superyacht market as part of our big essay that we're running in the January issue about the market. As part of that, I've been looking at Credit Suisse's annual wealth report and Goldman Sachs' wealth report. And actually, Goldman Sachs has done a whole sub-report on what a blue wave might do to the global markets in general. So obviously it's a huge factor there. And obviously we don't really know yet what's going to happen because we don't know the result. So the indecision in itself might be a big factor in the market. We'll have to wait and see. But looking at all that, the real message seems to be that the only people who are going to come out of this year really on top are the Chinese, who seem to be doing rather well. But if you want to have a better understanding of how this year's fluxes have affected the superyacht industry and will affect it next year, then do take a look at our January issue, where we're going to have a very interesting in-depth piece on that.
We just need to get the Chinese buying super yachts.
Well, exactly. That would solve everybody's problems.
That's
great.
The key. Yeah. I remember, I've been in this industry for a little while. And so even 15, 20 years ago, people would say, China, 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 it's fine because China's going to come in and start buying tons of yachts. And then boat yards will be fabulously well, you know, but it just hasn't happened for various reasons. There's been various anti-corruption crackdowns and crackdowns of displays of kind of ostentatious wealth and things like that. And obviously super yachts and big yachts fall into that category. So it's been a kind of a stop-start process for the Chinese super yacht buyer. But, you know, fingers crossed. There are occasionally green shoots you see. Also, you know, a Chinese buyer will come and buy a very big yacht indeed, and you think that's going to be the start of some kind of mass movement into yachting. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. We might be waiting a little bit longer.
Exactly. I mean, another thing to bear in mind, China aside, is just that from what we've seen on the market, there seems to have been a huge evolution in terms of technology and the improvement of super yacht businesses this year, because they've had to get more modern, they've had to improve, they've had to become leaner, better operations. So one of the experts that we spoke to for this piece said that there's been basically 5 years of evolution in the industry in 6 months, which can only be a good thing.
Yeah, I definitely think we've seen that. Yeah. Even just the people we've been working with over this period, you've noticed people kind of taking a lot more interest in what's happening online and what's going out on our digital platforms, and just changing the way they work to be a lot more agile. And I think that's going to be a really productive thing for the industry going forward.
Yeah, necessity is the mother of invention. Is that the saying?
Yeah.
Anyway, got it right. It'll be I think it's kind of reshaped lots of industries, not least ours. So kind of we'll see what 2021 brings, but it's a very different looking kind of super yacht business to what it was at the end of 2019, certainly. Right, some event news. Sadly, the Explorer Yacht Summit in Monaco that was due to take place on the 12th of November has been cancelled. That was a boat international event run in partnership with ExplorerYachts.com. With spiking COVID cases across Europe, the event became just untenable, and the safety of our guests and speakers, etc., was obviously paramount. We'll let you know when next year's event will take place, but we had some really great speakers lined up, so it's obviously very disappointing to have to cancel it, but we are looking at ways to bring you the content that was going to be presented via this podcast and other means, either in the magazine or on the website or across our social channels. Charlotte, you've actually been, you'll be interviewing one of the speakers for the podcast in a couple of weeks. So, who is that?
If you keep an ear out, you should hear an interview with him very soon. That's a guy called Pete Murphy. He owns a security company called Priavo. And I am sad that we're not going to be in Monaco together, because the presentation he had put together was fantastic. But he's a really interesting guy. He really knows his stuff. He's kind of ex-special forces. He's the kind of person that if you were stranded on a very deadly desert island, you would feel in safe hands with him nearby. But it was interesting what he was saying, that actually a lot of super yacht owners are still going on adventures this year and next to really quite kind of out there places, both in terms of how remote they are and how potentially dangerous they are as a yacht owner. But something he said that I thought, yeah, that's a good point, actually, is that lots of owners during this time are obviously hunkering down on their lovely yacht. But if they're staying in the same place, they're kind of making themselves a sitting target for people with not so great intentions. And things like, if you're flying to your yacht on your plane, if sort of local cartels or things recognize your plane, then they instantly know where you're heading to. So hopefully he'll come on this podcast and give us a bit of advice about how you can kind of stay safe during this time, what you need to know. And one of the other things he highlighted that I thought was quite interesting, he was kind of talking about the importance of local guides. And I was saying, well, yeah, we hear this a lot, but is it that necessary if you're with a really great captain and a really experienced crew? And he said, well, yeah, the analogy that I always use is the town on football day analogy, which is basically, you know, if I went out to a town near me and it was football day and there was trouble brewing because of opposing teams or whatever, I would just kind of sense it in the atmosphere that something felt a bit off and a bit odd, and maybe it was a strange situation. And he said that's what you need them for. Local people pick up on changes in atmosphere that even the most experienced team just don't know. So I thought that was a good way of putting it, and I'm looking forward to talking to him in more detail very soon.
Yeah, I look forward to hearing that. Obviously, security is a massively important issue for these yachts when they're going all around the world as they are. And, you know, that's certainly we're hearing, it's interesting to hear that he's getting reports that boats are going, you know, that this situation hasn't affected the adventures owners are having. And, you know, that's reflected in what we're hearing as well. And that people are spending longer on board and they're thinking, you know, this is the opportunity. This is the kind of the life break I've needed to spend a bit more time on the boat or go to that crazy place or do that passage, etc. Nothing focuses the mind like being locked in your home, I suppose. Some other event news, obviously, I hope many of you have signed up to take part in the virtual World Super Yacht Awards. That's taking place on the 13th of November. I think it's a 6 o'clock kickoff in the evening. I'm not too sure. So just check the website for details on that. You can register to take part there, but it should be a really good show. And to find out which boats our judges decided were the very best this year. Lots of speculation, and the results will be revealed exclusively on the 13th of November. Friday the 13th, ominously, although hopefully the show will go without a hitch. Caroline, what other news have you got for us?
Well, the Miami Boat Show sadly has been cancelled. That was due to take place in February next year. The Fort Lauderdale Boat Show, of course, went ahead last weekend, and our colleague Cecile Gowett was there to check it out. She said that it was about a third of the usual size. And of course, there were no international visitors that she could see, very few international designers or builders. But it seemed to be a great success. She said going there by water taxi felt very safe, open air. All of the exhibitors were being very careful about COVID safety rules. So, for example, Ocean Alexander was really spacing out visits, being very careful to keep everyone safe. Visitors themselves were being quite free about whether they were wearing masks or not. But in general, people were keeping to the rules and it felt like quite a safe place to be. She felt that overall it was a success, although obviously it was smaller than it would normally have been. So that was quite an interesting insight, I thought.
Yeah, I still can't believe it took place, really. I've seen a few pictures coming out of it. And yeah, the reports that have come back have been quite favourable. So good on the organisers for pulling that off in the middle of a pandemic. I think it's the first big boat show of the year, really. I can't think of...
Genoa. Took place.
Genoa, that's right. Yeah.
Got in there just under the wire before Italy got bad again. So it was fortunate that took place as well in Europe. But I think in Europe that was about, so it's pretty much been Flibs and Genoa. I think there's been much else. So in yard news, FedShip's been very busy. They have launched the 76.5 meter boardwalk, which you can see on a news story on our website if you're interested. It's the fourth new build launched by the yard in 2020. The others are 100-metre Moonrise, 73-metre Podium and 50-metre Totally Nuts. So really not bad on the size scale for such a weird year. Another FedShip project that's been revealed for the first time is Project 708, which is a 55-metre. And that was spotted coming out of a build shed to be moved to Alsmere for outfitting. That is a beautiful Explorer by Briand under his Vitruvius Explorer brand.
Really cool looking boat, this. Like, you know, it's great lines, bang on trend for an Explorer, and Briand just doesn't get it wrong, does he? I mean, that guy just draws a beautiful boat, so that is going to do well. It's just great for his portfolio, it's great for the industry. I can't wait to finally see that when she's delivered.
He's a nice guy as well, Briand. I mean, we deal with all these designers in different capacities and I've met him a few times and I just always think he's incredibly talented but incredibly humble as well, and very keen on sort of mentoring the next generation and helping young yacht designers flourish, which is really nice to see. So definitely keen to see that.
Yeah, he does seem like a lovely guy, and it's his breadth of talent's quite amazing because he's obviously a sailing yacht designer who also designs Explorer yachts. And both sets of designs are beautiful, so a really talented man. So in other yard news, Broadwater has completed a major refit. It's actually such a big project that it's being described almost as a rebuild. It included a 4-metre extension, which obviously is quite a big deal. And this is a 56-metre fed ship that was refitted at Husefit, which is Royal Houseman's refit arm. It's been transformed into a modern and livable home away from home, the yard says. And it has a new interior and exterior designed by Adam Voorhees, who had worked with the owner on the refit of another classic Fed ship. So he has some experience in this area. The sun deck was rebuilt and the yacht has a new composite mast and hardtop, as well as a new jacuzzi and bar and dayhead all up on the sun deck. The contemporary interior replaces the traditional one in the guest and crew areas, so she'll be a lovely, light, modern place to be. And the conversion also included a change from private use to commercial use, so the yacht can be chartered, which is a very practical measure. If you're looking at her from the outside and trying to see what's changed, you could take a look at her stern, which has been completely remodeled and now includes an extended aft deck and beach club.
I spoke to the owner, Matt, during lockdown. We did a video series called At Home with Boat, and it was just basically the first lockdown, rather, not the second one. So that was basically just me talking to various people from the industry about, you know, life under the shadow of COVID. And so Matt and I had a long conversation about this boat, about his previous boats, and why he added the beach club. And it was obviously because he's you know, uses the boats, charters the boats extensively and runs a really successful charter program. So he loved this boat. He loves classic Fed ships, but it for this to be a really successful charter yacht, it needed a beach club. So that's why he stuck on that 4 meter extension. But you can find that interview actually via the website or just YouTube Boat International channel. It's all there. Thanks, Caroline, for all those headlines. Charlotte, meanwhile, you've been your elbow deep in the January issue, putting all that together at the moment, including the big feature in the January issue every year is the top 101, which is basically a listing of all the biggest boats in the world. And we do little kind of featurettes effectively on all the big new deliveries this year, all the new boats, the new entries in the top 101. So what news have you got for us on the 101?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of my favourite features of the year because I think no one doesn't enjoy reading about these huge new boats and they're always shrouded in secrecy. So our writer and the rest of the team here have been doing a great job digging out every tiny little snippet of information they can find from, you know, yacht spotters taking photos of things being moved between sheds to people who've kindly given us little tidbits of information. And some of the boats sound incredible. But some of the things that kind of just stood out as that's an interesting thing to know. One of the boats, Nord, has an entire deck devoted to its owner, which sounded pretty cool. It's got a big study as well. So it kind of plays into this idea that people are planning on spending a lot more time on board. And it's got space for 16 tenders in its garage. So it's massive.
16 tenders.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
It's 142 meters long and it's a Lursen yacht and it'll be their fifth largest yacht ever. So that's really, really big and sounds very cool. And then another one I thought was interesting was this yacht Scheherazade, which I think Caroline's going to talk about a bit later. But that has very little outdoor space comparatively. And it kind of made me realize, I think we get used to all these yachts cruising the Med and the Caribbean and owners saying how much they want space outdoors and kind of bringing the outside in. But because this owner wants to use it in the Middle East, they actually want as much enclosed space as possible. And even the kind of on-deck spaces are somewhat covered and things to keep them cool in those temperatures. So I thought that was an interesting thing to note. And it was nice to see that Fedship's new boat Moonrise has apparently got exceptionally high-end staff quarters. So that's nice. And it's meant to be particularly quiet and including in those areas for staff on the boat. So we kind of have been looking for a while now about certain owners kind of prioritizing crew areas, making crew cabins bigger. And that's really nice to see, especially on a boat of this size, you've got space to do it. So it's nice that people are starting to make those changes.
The same is true in Artifact, actually. So the Artifact has a really unusual GA, and that's on the cover of our December issue, which is out shortly. So Artifact has prime real estate on the main deck forward that has been dedicated to crew, which would usually be guest cabins or some other guest space. So yeah, good on these owners building these really big boats, giving crew the space they need and deserve to operate a boat effectively.
I think that's one of those things that below deck program that we keep banging on about has really brought home, is that the kind of, for a lot of crew, the reality of going back home to your tiny cabin after a very, very long day is slightly crushing. So it's nice that they might have a bit more luxury themselves. That's great. And then another yacht that sort of ties in with things we've been keeping an eye on is Au Paris, which has got a hospital cabin and also lifts to connect to all of the decks. So it's a lot more accessible. So you know, we'll be doing a feature in the future about sort of medical facilities on yachts and making yachts more accessible for people who want to spend longer on board and have the facilities they need in case of an emergency. So we'll be looking a bit more closely at that. And lastly, there was Olivia O, who sounded like a very interesting boat. One of the things I thought was interesting was the design sounds quite industrial. They're talking about steel borders around the windows. And you think of all these yachts that have crew spending hours polishing kind of brass or steel and things that look very shiny and very polished. But this seems a lot more kind of rough around the edges in quite a cool way, because they were also talking about lots of very luxurious sort of Japanese fabrics on board, I think. So I'm keen to see pictures of that. And she also has a very special bow. It's a patented X-bow, which apparently mitigates the impact of heavy seas and makes life on board a lot more comfortable during those difficult passages.
So in a similar-ish vein to Ragnar, which, again, we featured recently, that kind of reverse bow, massive reverse bow. And, yeah, I mean, it's an industrial application taking from the kind of offshore industry, slightly more commercial hull shapes. And, it's used for punching through massive seas, basically, and with as little impact as possible on ride comfort. So, it'd be interesting to see if that's all borne out, really, in the experiences of the crews on board. Certainly, the early reports we've had from Ragnar is that it's a very seaworthy boat. So, assuming the same will be for Olivia Rowe. So lots of big boats are going to be featured in the January issue. Some new massive launches entering the top 101 this year. And Carolyn, you've been digging down into a bit more about some of these boats, particularly those ones built in Germany. So tell us more. What have you found?
Yeah, I mean, you can't really talk about the biggest super yachts without talking about German yards. They do build the biggest boats in the world. So we spoke to Raphael Montenu, our resident data genius, who's based in the south of France. He keeps an eye on all of this stuff for us. So what makes it particularly appropriate is the christening of Lursen's 142-metre Project Opus on the weekend, which is now named Nord. So we were looking at other boats that have been launched in the last decade and what that means for the German industry. So in the last decade was really a record decade for the German superyacht industry. 59 super yachts were delivered with an average length of approximately 90 meters.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty enormous. Four super yachts were delivered this year so far, even given the fact it's been an odd year. So that's pretty impressive. 68 meter Aberking Soaring on the market now. 80 meter Nobbskrog Artifacts, which we have spoken about today. The 87-metre Lursen Advantage and the 140-metre Lursen Scheherazade, which Charlotte mentioned a second ago. You can check out the January issue for the full rundown on those boats, which will be running in the top 101, as Charlotte mentioned. So over the years, the average LOA of German yachts has grown steadily. Between 1990 and 2000, it was 46.45 metres, which was pretty big for then. Between 2000 and 2010, it was 70.42 metres, so a massive growth there. Between 2010 and 2020, it was 89.48 metres, and between 2020 and 2025, it will be 100.44 metres.
That's wild. So from 1990 to 2000, the average length of German-built superyachts was 46.45 metres.
Yeah.
Just 20 years later, it's double that. The average length is now, or will be in the next 5 years, 100.44 metres. Phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that the German shipyards have really cut out a niche in building the very biggest yachts, so you would expect this, but it is pretty incredible. It's also interesting that the numbers of yachts built have grown steadily. So between 1990 and 2000, it was 38. 2000 and 2010, it was 57. 2010 and 2020, 59, and 2020 and 25, we know that 18 will be built and delivered, but more are very likely to join that list. Of the 300 German ship super yachts already in existence, 59 are in the 70 to 100 metre bracket, 32 are in the 100 metre plus category. So a lot of German shipyards will feature in the top 101 yachts.
Yeah, they kind of really dominate that space. All their Dutch boats are getting bigger too. Fedship have announced 120. No, Amels have announced 120 meter, and Fedship have just launched 118 meter. I think that was the new Espen boat that we saw the other week. So Holland building bigger but not catching up. I mean, that's amazing. And you think about the figures aren't being skewed by fewer and fewer builds either, because you kind of think, well, if the average has gone up to 100 meters, if that's only a couple of boats, you can kind of understand it. But it's not at all. There's more and more boats, so it's a genuine expansion of both numbers of boats being built and the size of those boats. So good on Germany.
Yeah, absolutely. And looking to the future, no less than 4 deliveries are scheduled at Lürssen next year. 142-metre Nord, which I mentioned a few minutes ago, 115-metre Project Enzo and 90-metre Project 1601 and 55-metre Project 13800. 2 projects are scheduled at Nobbeskrug for next year, 62-metre hull 794 and 77-metre hull 793. The giant explorer yacht Solaris is due for delivery next year at Lloyd Werft. That is 140 metres long. And to complement all these giants, Y Yachts will launch a 27-metre trip design sailing yacht. So it's not just the biggest yachts, also some of the most interesting and pretty.
There you go. Go Y Yachts. Thanks, Caroline. Some great insights there. As ever, check out Boat Pro, where you can dig through all this data yourself. You can find that on the website. It's a great platform for gathering a bit more intelligence about the superyacht market. Right. I realise rather guiltily now, as we get to the end of the news bit, that I haven't actually mentioned who this week's interview is. So Caroline sat down with Neil Fox from Based on a True Story, all about amazing adventures he has organised. Instead of me talking about it, why don't you, Caroline, tee up the interview and tell us a bit about Neil and, lead us in.
So Neil Fox is founder and CEO of a company called Based on a True Story, and I'm obsessed with this company. They are more like a creative agency for ultra-high net worth individuals than a travel company. They create incredible experiences, and I mean absolutely incredible experiences in a literal sense. They can put on sort of fantasy adventures for families. They put on unbelievable month-long honeymoons, anything that you want, they will create some sort of mind-blowing adventure for you. I think it's probably better if Neil tells you a little bit more about it. So without further ado, here is my interview with Neil Fox, founder and CEO of Based on a True Story. So Neil, you are CEO of Based on a True Story. So it would be wonderful if you could tell us to start off with a little bit about yourself and how you got into this very unusual business.
Hi, yeah, good morning. I started traveling at a very early age and founded a creative agency in my early 20s, which enabled me to travel 2 years on, 2 years off. I kind of got bewitched when I was in Australasia when I was 17 years old. And so I started to amass an awful lot of travel experience. And mostly I was kind of hitchhiking a lot on yachts. So I'd, you know, when there's an ocean to cross, I'd hitchhike on a yacht, help out, cook, whatever, crew. And I I sailed across all the oceans. And during the period of that agency, I just got to the point where I clearly wasn't meant to be in the city. And in 2000, I sold up everything and I set off on this mission to go natural power from the United Kingdom, Yorkshire, to Antarctica. And it was nearly 40,000 kilometres. I sailed on 11 yachts, natural power, climbed most of the big hills on the way, and some first ascents in Antarctica, raised money for orphan kids. And, it was a sort of everyday, one at a time sort of thing. Now, on that journey, right time, right place in Venezuela, I was drafted in to help out with some very, very wealthy individuals. And so from a very zen world on my bike, I stepped off and went into this rather unusual world. And then I was another year on the bike, cycling down South America, not really sure what I was going to do next. As I said, cut off my ties with the UK and decided it would probably be a good idea to give this one of these fellows a call. And ended up being his fixer for pretty much the next year and a half, 2 years. And that gentleman became quite a prominent person in the superyacht industry, well known. And that was basically how things started. And I would plan his adventures and journeys. And I had a passion for photography. My background was creativity. So I was always trying to create things very, very differently. And that was pretty much the DNA for the business that I founded in 2005, which was based on a true story.
So can you tell me exactly what Based on a True Story does and how it feeds into the superyacht experience?
Yeah, right from the very start, our approach was very, very different. So I came from pretty much an expedition background, and I've got no interest in packaging experience. So quite different to the rest of the travel industry, particularly at that time. Every project was like a creative brief for me. So I wanted to understand as much as possible about the object, the problem, if you like, what the person needed, and then to try and create something unique. So we run as a business a bit more like a creative agency than a travel, a conventional travel company. If you like it, we creatively manage leisure time. Really, right from the very, very start, we've only really worked with ultra high net worth people and royal families seeking ways to do things very, very special. Now, most of those clients either have yachts or they charter them. So we've been always very, very much involved in yachts. And I guess from my sort of expedition background, I'm always really keen to try and work out strategic ways to use the yacht, to try and get the very, very most out of the investment, and to do things different or do things in a unique way, to avoid tourists, to avoid tourist infrastructures. So we kind of, I guess you could say, we provide assurance to the super yacht investment, highly strategic and highly creative, good old-fashioned fun. And we're always on the ground to manage the experiences. So we provide assurance and fix the needs. But really, more so than anything else, we're a creative business. So we're looking to do things differently.
Fantastic. Okay, so referring specifically to the superyacht industry there, can you tell us a little bit about what you do for those clients?
Yeah, so I guess in the very, very basic I guess you could say we ensure everything is perfect, super styling, if you like. So when the guests or client or owner steps on shore, everything is just been really well thought through. It's super slick. It runs incredibly smoothly. So if they're going to the restaurant, it's the best restaurant. It's hosted by the owner. It's at the best table. We've talked about the food, and the food is absolutely spot on. So there's no risk in anything, really. If we're on a really lovely anchorage, they can just go ashore and there would be a beautiful setup on the beach, private chef, acoustic musicians, and lots of space, really special creative touches. I guess trying to get to the very essence of the location that we're in and serving it up as exclusively as possible. So kind of that's the basic element. Then we do a lot of strategic planning for expeditions, so taking the yachts to areas they wouldn't usually go. And the guests experience some very, very special, unique activities when they get on shore. And then I guess the area that we've become quite well known as a business is the sort of fantasy area, where reality and fantasy are blurred. And that can be for both children and adults.
Okay, so could you take us through just briefly the categories that you would sort of split your work into? And then can you give us a little bit of detail or some examples on each one of those so we can get a real picture of what it is that you do?
Yeah. So basic adventure, I think that's the heart of the business. So we create adventures, we create expeditions. We do family journeys that are very specific to families. We do the magical fantasy stuff I talked about, which... as I said, can be for adults or children. We do a lot of honeymoons. We've become a bit of a go-to honeymoon company these days, particularly in the Middle East. We do events, and we like to surprise. So we do some jobs where the client doesn't actually know where they're going or what's going to happen. They just trust us. And then we're doing increasingly more work in philanthropy, which has pretty much been the backbone of the business from day one, really. But these days we're actually kind of more... I guess you could say packaging it, or not so much that there is a strategic backbone to a project. I guess adventure is trying to bring out the adventure in everybody and to try and get guests to step into new adventures, if you like. So, for example, the yachts could go to the Andaman Islands or something. So that would be somewhere very, very new. There's an awful lot of islands there that aren't inhabited, so you can have an awful lot of privacy. The diving is incredible. The sports fishing is amazing. And we've hosted guests with the Maharaja. So, you know, we do some work on the yacht. We explore a bit, and then we step offshore and fly out. And quite literally, we bring a life, the exuberant life of the Maharajas. And it can be really, really quite extraordinary. So adventure, yeah, and that can be absolutely anywhere in the world, and that's suitable for all. Expedition, we look to ways to do things differently, which is, I guess, the very basis of an expedition. Highly strategic and creative. Raja Ampat would be a good example, or West Papua, should I say. So basing the yacht or starting in Raja Ampat with a nice sort of leisurely start, exploring stunning islands, amazing biodiversity under the ocean, and great islands to discover. We've worked with manta ray conservation there. And then while it's a good opportunity there for the yacht to relocate to a place that's, I guess, less interesting to crews, and we've taken guests inland to into the highlands to meet up with the likes of the Dani. And they're just a fascinating anthropological feast, really. And we've developed part of the village so that the clients stay in adobe huts, but are very, very luxuriously appointed silk sheets and butlers and private chefs, and really, really nice. But in essence, they're spending time with a Stone Age tribe. And these guys are absolutely amazing. And then we would fly from there to where the yacht, to rendezvous with the yacht, where, for example, there's whale sharks, a good density of guarantee whale shark encounters, and spend a bit of time with them. Then we might head back on shore again and spend some time with birds of paradise or something like that, you know, see the wildlife. And then on the last job we did there, we actually cruised into a river mouth, went up the river and discovered a tribe that had only been seen once before us, and then only briefly. And we spent 48 hours with them, a group called the Taos. And it was truly remarkable. I mean, I don't think they had any notion of an outside world whatsoever. Family adventure. So becoming increasingly popular, this element, I guess, where the children, it's really about the children. And, you know, a good example of that would be discovering Europe. So a Mediterranean cruise, but when the kids step off on shore, history comes alive in front of them. There can be dress-ups, there can be little quests, so they've got to get into some sort of site and find something or other, and some actors will spring out and sort of bring the whole thing alive. But it's kind of like, I guess you could say, school, but loads of fun, highly interactive and challenging. And we get all the family, of course, involved in that. Everybody's dressing up. And you know, learning, but really, really fun.
God, that sounds wonderful. Much better than the classroom. I'm sure we'd learn a lot more.
Yeah. And then the magical fantasy, as I said, that can take all sorts of guises. But we did one we were asked to keep the children busy. That was the basic brief for a very large 100-plus-meter yacht. And the idea we came up with, the creative angle, was that children don't really believe in magic anymore, that everything is fixed within sort of bounds of technology. And the idea was that magic was dying out as a consequence. So what happened was we kept along, you know, most of this back as a surprise, but the children saw, or some of the children saw, a mermaid and then disappeared. And we played a little illusion that we told the adults, just pretend you don't see any of this stuff. So the children were kind of couldn't believe that the adults couldn't see it, but they'd seen a mermaid, and the mermaid disappeared. And then we found on the rock where she'd slid off a cask, and in that cask was a plea to believe in magic, and anything could happen, that magical things would happen if they believed in them. And they had to go, and everything, actually, the entire trip was written in rhyme. So every single person they encountered pretty much had pointy ears, and we're talking a cast of thousands of actors, actresses, and extras. And they had to first go off and find, I think it was a Nisse, which is a little mischievous farmland spirit, if you like. And he then led them onto a Fosse Grimmen, who's underneath the waterfall. And then it was a troll, and the kids had to bake a cake because the trolls really like cakes, and they had to do it at dusk. And and then it was a witch in Bergen, then there was elves, and then a dwarf. And then finally they got to the epicenter of magic, which was in Tallinn, which we'd actually arranged a good chunk of Tallinn to be sort of cordoned off. And we did this amazing event. So as the children were coming in, they were so supercharged with magic, everybody started waking up. So everyone was kind of trapped in this spell of nobody believing in them, and all down. And they just woke everybody up as they were walking along. It was an amazing, spectacular finale.
God, that sounds like the production of a film or something. It must be such a massive task to put something like that together. Incredible.
Good fun, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, we get the basic idea and you just chip more and more into it. And when you get on the ground, on reconnaissance, you can really start to get creative.
So tell us about the honeymoons you mentioned.
Yeah, we've just seemed to have really got some traction with this of recent years. And, you know, a lot of them are a month long. They go around the world. They very often feature a super yacht. One I can tell you a little bit about. So this particular honeymoon started on Valentine's Day. And in Italy, on Valentine's Day, they give a key to the heart of their partner. So that's a tradition that they have. And we design a mark or a crest or a logo, if you like, for every single trip that we do. That gets applied in all sorts of clever ways, from little creative educational pieces, which are on adorn the table at lunches and dinners, etc., to all sorts of, you know, cufflinks, dressing gowns and towels, and all sorts of different ways that we crystal glass, etc. In this particular case, we use the initials of the couple to form the key, a key-like crest. And so it created a beautiful mark. And we actually had that put onto a beautiful rosewood box that we had carved with a gold inlay, which the couple discovered on this amazing setup in it's a Renaissance style setup. And in that, when they opened that up, there were eight compartments for the eight different chapters or eight different locations within the honeymoon. And the first compartment was with a little key in there and a little label on there saying Hemingway's Key West. So, you know, the whole honeymoon was a surprise. They jetted off to Hemingway's, to Key West, should I say. When they get there, they get to Hemingway's home. There's a lock on the door. They open the lock, and behind the door is Hemingway. He's taking off the bandages from his gloves because he's a boxer. He sort of says, come on in. He's smoking a cigar. He invites them over. All his Cuban friends are there. And then there's a big fiesta going on in his backyard. And he sort of says, welcome. And then so it's a wonderful evening of celebration for the couple. At some point, he says he found this beautiful piece of jewellery. So there's a piece of jewellery for every location. And he also found a key on a wreck. And that key has some coordinates on it, some GPS coordinates. And that leads him on to the next place, which I think in that case was St. Bart's. And then that key opened up a mansion, and then it led to a carnival, and it sort of turned a bit voodoo. And a shaman gave him another key, and then that went on, I think, to the BVIs, where they got onto again, it was a very big yacht, 100-meter yacht. And they had a little brush. There was pirate on the GPS reference there. There was pirates actually in the bay. There was two big pirate yachts, and again, it was kind of dusk time, but they ended up going ashore. Their key actually opened up Blackbeard's box, and Blackbeard actually had a key for their box. Anyway, it was quite a lot of fun, and they had an amazing celebration. It was an incredible night. So yeah, it was a really good one, and it just went on and on and on. Ended up in
New York. Incredible.
Yeah, so all around keys.
Fantastic. Okay. And then the philanthropy element that you mentioned at the beginning, can you tell us a bit more about how that feeds into the experiences?
Yeah, we always try to work some angle when we're on the ground. That's something that's actually rather than just sort of donating towards some charity or other. We try and find something that actually really needs to be done. And you know, it's sometimes something just we do, or something we get the client involved and we really go big. It really depends on the client, and or we start the momentum and then the client gets involved too when we expose them to it. And Yeah, we were in the Mergui in Burma. So the super yacht based, beautiful explorer yacht. And we were splitting up the time between exploring some of the Mergui, then heading on inland, and then back to them. So it started off on the yacht. Then we had some exploration of Burma, including an Irrawaddy cruise, which was really cool. And then we ended up back on the yacht again. But anyway, on the reconnaissance, we came across a tribe of the Moken who pretty much lost their way and had done for quite a few years. They'd lost their boat. And these people are the people of the boat. I mean, they live on the boat, multiple generations living on one boat. And it looked pretty much like these guys had given up all hope of ever getting back on the water again. And I don't know how old the culture is, many thousands of years. We needed to do something about it. So we actually we got together the hardwood and the tools to enable them, shipped all that in basically to enable them to build the boat, which they called, based on the story, they kind of got the name wrong, which is quite funny. But so we have a yacht in the Mergui called Based on the Story. It's even got my name on it. But anyway, okay. We're always looking for some way to help.
And then, so I understand you also do some sort of amazing launches for yachts on a slightly more pedestrian scale compared to what you do in some of these fabulous places. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, we've done quite a few launch parties for yachts, lots and lots of fun, because you can kind of try and realise the dream at the yacht party rather than just sit around getting drunk and smashing some champagne on the hull. We try and actually realise the potential of the yacht and get the owner and the family behind it, that there is, you know, again, it's a great opportunity for us to actually kind of develop a maiden voyage and potentially some vision for the use of the yacht. But you know, we try and create a very, very clever, creative angle for everyone to have a lot of fun and celebrate whatever it is, a five-year build or whatever it's been. And so that can then lead into something creative. We've actually planted some little seeds, a catalyst, if you like, secret catalyst there that have kind of ended up leading on to things that become a reality.
Mm. Fantastic. Okay. And then the dreaded question, can you give me an idea of the price tag for some of your experiences?
Yeah. I mean, we obviously, the more you invest, the more creative we can be. We tend to sort of say that we're not really a concierge company, so we're not really the right company to just call up for a one-off event unless it needs to be very, very special. So, you know, if you're needing a cappuccino in Milan, we're not, or having some issues with something or other, you need a moped or something, call me, I'll probably find you somebody. But we're not that sort of company. We are looking to strategically manage all that time and to make sure it's amazingly wonderful according to your needs. So we tend to start at about 250 grand. A lot of our work extends into seven figures. Everything is based on industry rates, so we're transparent on all our costings. I would argue we're extremely good value, but we do work with some of the biggest budgets in the industry.
Mm, okay. So given all of your experience, could you tell us how you think the superyacht industry could change potentially to improve the experiences that the industry offers to guests and owners? So how they could alter their approach to improve guest experiences?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak on behalf of the whole industry because we just get a very small taste of it. But I think, you know, the strategic development of how the time is going to be spent is always quite a big one. I certainly notice a lot of the time that there really hasn't been that much time, or there hasn't been a really good communication chain to be able to really nail what the people are expecting when they get on the boat. So, you know, they've spent, you know, $500,000 or whatever on the charter, and there hasn't really been they've answered a few questions and there's some idea and they know roughly where they're going, but, you know, kind of really digging down deep and really trying to work out what floats these people's boat. I think a lot of work, don't get me wrong, an awful lot of work goes into all the likes that they want on the yacht. It's more when they get to a location, what they're going to do. And I think a lot of the infrastructure, again, I don't want to upset anybody here, but quite often there'll be a black book, and it's a port office that they call, and they've done a good job before, and they organise things. And you know, for me, that's very, very it's very mainstream tourism, and we try to do the very, very opposite of that. We've never repeated a journey. We never will. We've never done anything twice. We're trying to make sure whatever we do is one off. The experience is unique. So, yeah, I think trying not to be quite so predictable. And I don't really want, as I said, I don't want to offend anybody. I just think it's a time thing. Authenticity is another word. You know, for me, trying to get to the essence of the place. Particularly me, getting on a little bit now. But I always try and bring alive the culture or the essence of how things were before they kind of got overrun with tourists, when things were really real. So, you know, it takes a bit of digging around and to give that the assurance. And then I guess the other one is, there's never a better time than the here and now to try somewhere different. You know, I think an awful lot of yachts just sort of buzz around the same spot. Quite predictable stuff. And, you know, for me, they're just really wasting a great opportunity to do something, you know, really once in a lifetime, something amazing, something incredible, something to remember forever. So go somewhere different, plan something else. Let's get out and see the world. And again, get some strategy and some backbone and really get dig down deep into what floats these people's boats, so to speak. And then the other thing, as I said, is to, on the strategy side of things, the good thing with that, all of our journeys, because we're trying to get them on land and to see great things on land as well as the ocean, is, you know, that allows the captain and the crew to really reboot and to plan, to really get all the things done. I mean, I've seen how chaotic it can be and everything at last minute. But if things are really managed with time to a structure, and don't get me wrong, I mean, we have to come up with plans A's, B's and C's because weather very often throws a hex into things, or the client needs to meet somebody, a new guest is coming on board, or something's happening. So we've got all, have all our contingencies in place. But, getting the guests off the boat for an overnight or a couple of nights while the yacht gets to somewhere new and gets a chance to sort of for everyone to breathe and to get the systems all polished and be ready again is a great thing.
Okay, some good advice there. So this year has obviously been rather an unusual one. Can you tell us what you have been doing during the pandemic and how that's affected your work?
Yeah, it's been a tough one for the travel industry, that's for sure. We had a cracking year last year, and this year pretty much it's ground to a halt. But we've got an incredible team, amazing, amazing team of people, and we've been able to keep them all on. And everyone's been really focused on, I guess, redefining the business a little bit, actually sharpening our pencils up and producing lots and lots of inspiration, new marketing. We've got a new website. We've got new inspiration, which are little private websites that we provide for anybody who's a new client. It's a little area that we populate with all sorts of inspiration and fun things. We'll be making a lot of videos, sharpening up the database and whatnot. We've just started to get quite a few new inquiries, so we've been busy with those too. And we've also been developing strategies to mitigate the risk of COVID and whatever is next as well. So having people on the ground ahead that are just checking absolutely everything to make sure that everything is super tight.
So does that happen as part of your experiences, or is that a separate service? How exactly does that one work?
It will happen anyway as part of our service, but we can actually have an advanced team, if you like, or an advanced consultant, and their job just is, that's all it is just to be on the ground. I can't say it'll happen with all budgets, but it's a service just like any other service, I guess. You know, we're just doing what we always do, making things amazing, or as much as we can. And we're just, in this case, we're just, you know, mitigating any risk of any risk to health, any health risk.
Okay, fantastic. And then just as a sort of final sign off, do you have any final words for CPL owners, CPL guests in this slightly strange time, just to keep us going?
Yeah, no, I'd be very, very keen to help anybody to help provide some inspiration. We don't charge anything for that first stage. So if you are thinking about doing something, whether it's a captain thinking about something for their owner, to try and motivate them to do something to get out to the big blue rather than keep local, we'd be very, very happy to work with you on producing a beautiful presentation. And our presentations are works of art. They're beautiful things, highly inspiring. So we could definitely, we would be very much up for coming up with some ideas. Or we can take a good look at some real creative ideas for what to do with a family, children, or a group of adults, whatever. Yeah, so we can help with some inspiration. We'd love to.
Fantastic. Okay, well, thank you so much, Neil. Really appreciate your time, and it's been very interesting hearing about all your adventures. And I hope you'll be able to do some more early next year. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Caroline. That's it for this week's Boat Briefing podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you next week. Have a good one.